So we can have a period of discussions and questions, answers now. There's a wandering microphone, so I would ask anyone who wants to ask a question to wait until the microphone arrives before you pose your question, so that everyone can hear, including me. So, and if we can stick to the theme that I was speaking about this afternoon, rather than ancillary topics or remote topics, then that helps to keep it focused. So please, anyone who'd like to ask anything about what I was reflecting on earlier today, please. With a microphone?
Thank you, Adrian. my question with simplicity is, I think for some of us, so like for me, it's possible for me to renounce things, to try to live more simply. It's an option because I have things to renounce and I have the ability to buy things. But for a lot of people in the world, simplicity is something that's forced on them through economic inequality. So I'm just curious how the topic of simplicity and economic inequality and economic injustice come together.
Yeah, good question. In a way, it's to do with education, so that within the countries where there's a lot of poverty, usually there's a certain amount of people who are holding a lot of power and a lot of the wealth. And in the with education, then you can, to some degree, bring those values into the society, both educating the haves and the children of the haves, in terms of what really brings about well-being in a society, and discouraging the qualities of accumulation, selfishness, and the destructive aspects of the kind of greed or misuse of resources, and educating people in the value of sharing and creating a broader quality of well-being. Yeah, I would say that when we talk about contentment, it's not about passivity. So that it's not about saying poor people should be glad of their lot. You know, you should celebrate the fact you've got nothing and you've got to walk 2 miles to go and get a bucket of water for your family. That's not that's not even a joke. I mean, that's how a lot of the world has to live. But even if you are in a very deprived situation where you have got poor resources, or that you're in a situation of great difficulty, still, you can work and be encouraged through the society or the education system to improve your lot. But even in the interim, you can learn how to work with what you've got, and to not be creating anger, not to be creating despair, not to be creating kind of numbness, but rather steadily working to help make your situation better. And so then I feel that the more there is a genuine sharing of knowledge, and when I talk about education, it's not just for people in certain sections of society, but the degree to which that these values can be sort of put forth and sustained. So for those that have, in the kind of power-holding aspect of society, they can be encouraged to be more caring and more thoughtful and supportive to those who don't have, who need care, and to, say, be motivated to spread the resources more evenly. And the people who are in a state of poverty or deprivation, it gives them more tools to work with the difficulties that they have, and also to see what opportunities they have. They can contribute to help sort of develop their own lot. So it's a misunderstanding. It's very common that when you talk about peacefulness or non-attachment, that it's talking about passivity or kind of disengagement. But it's in more, I would say, it's to do with skillful engagement, and to also be being ready to help those around you, to learn from the situation that you're in, and to offer what you can. Like there was And I remember seeing a project that was developed in Africa by a young lad who figured out a way to develop power generation in the village just through the kind of collecting junk and rubbish and kind of putting things together and making a little turbine to generate electricity so that then you could have some light in the village huts so you could read at nighttime and study. And it was a teenage boy just on his own initiative put that together, and then that got picked up and developed. And so in my understanding, then that had has had a very positive impact, and people have seen that and have stepped forth to support. So the more that I think the quality of well-being is recognized as being significance, and it kind of in the Buddhist understanding of things, it's more of a sort of trickle down from on top, rather than a sort of from sort of grassroots, beginning from the lower ends of the society. Often it's the people who are privileged who are in situations of power that can bring about changes that benefit a lot of other people in society. And so that nowadays what's being seen is that the quality of well-being is almost seen on a par with academic achievement in many schools. I have been in conversation with quite a few Buddhist teachers, Buddhist schools, and there was a Buddhist school in Chiang Mai in Thailand, and they developed a system they call value-based education. And the head teacher was invited to give a talk at this sort of international conference of teachers with 2,000 or 3,000 educators and educational publishers gathered together for this. And she said that the queues of people waiting to talk with her were enormous, and that people wanted to introduce this value-based education that puts the well-being of the child ahead of academic achievement. So that the schools that are based on, so just producing high scores, well, they also recognize there's huge amounts of depression, distress, self-harming amongst particularly the teenage population of students. And that there's a realization that even though these are children who go to very expensive schools from very well-to-do families, from people at the top end of society, they are mentally in a state of distress. In this country, last year, 40% of teenage girls between the ages of 13 and 16 had some kind of mental health treatment. 40%. Either seeing school counselors, psychiatrists, psychologists, 40%. That's a massive mental health issue. So if people recognize, okay, we need to look at well-being, high scores and those kind of materialistic achievements are not the whole thing. If we're producing a generation of distressed and depressed people, we are not succeeding. So if those qualities of well-being are recognized as being extremely important for the people in the top end of society, and then also that trickles down to the other schools, the other living situations in the workplace, the prevalence of mindfulness programs now in the education, in medical health, mental health, in the business world. It's to do with the recognition of the importance of well-being. So I'm not a kind of social philosopher or sociologist, but I could see the more that is something that rises to the top of people's attention, like, okay, well-being is more important than cash flow for the company, for the family, for the school, for the university, for the hospital. Okay, this is what we're aiming at. It's not just this bottom line or this particular educational outcome or medical outcome, the well-being of the individual. That's what matters. Okay. So then, for that to translate steadily through to a concern for the well-being of the whole population, then that I would see as being something that, with the right attitude, with the right understanding, could be, a resource that steadily benefits all of society. I'm not a utopian. I'm not saying, you know, within 100 years we'll all be living happily ever after. But rather, if those values are seen as more important than personal wealth, more important than personal power, that then and the well-being of a country is not just in the size of the GNP, but, you know, gross national happiness is more important than gross national product. And Bhutan, a small Buddhist kingdom, is actually a kind of world leader in this. And but you have first world countries, kind of G8 countries that or G7 countries that pay attention to Bhutan for establishing that that standard of gross national happiness as the more important measure than gross national product. So I feel that the more that value system can be brought into view and praised and acknowledged, then that has a trickle-down effect, and slowly and surely that can have a beneficial effect on the world. I could go on, but I'll leave it there for now. So you had a question at the front. If you can pass the microphone forward.
My question is regarding balance. You talked about yourself and how you had held back from many things until Adam Smedo passed you that cake and said you had to have it. Can I ask you how, after that, you obviously, I think you imply that you realised that actually this wasn't helping you, you just gathered a lot more other things. How did you go back? How did you find the mean, the right amount to have? That's what I'm trying to say, I think. That's it. A balance. How do you find out what the right amount is?
Well, you'll be pleased to know there's a Pali word for that, which is matanyuta. Matanyuta means knowing the right amount. And it's a lot to do with meditation and mindfulness and an attunement of the mind to the time, the place, the situation. So if you have a formula, it won't work. You know, if you've got it's good to have a standard or an ideal, but just attaching to a standard or an ideal, it's automatically going to be out of whack with the way life is, because life is in a constant state of change. And so you have a principle of, say, okay, I want to train myself to eat, you know, the right amount to sustain the welfare of the body, and not to get too skinny or too fat, and to look after the life of this body and this being in the best way possible. So you have that as the ideal or the principle, and then there's the moment of, you know, you go out for a coffee with your friend Tom, and then then there's a living situation. You go, okay, so what's happening? What's available? How do I feel? So if you say, okay, well, I was going to eat the right amount. Now, what is the right amount? And which of those cakes, which of those sandwiches would be the right amount? So then you're trying to, you're going through the sort of the left brain. You're trying to apply a formula. And it's rather like playing a sport or a musical instrument or doing a painting. If it's painting by numbers or following a formula on the sports field or on the orchestra pit, as soon as you're following a formula, you're automatically out of tune. You have the score in front of you, but then you're listening to what the other musicians are doing. There's the canvas in front of you and there's the paints, but then there's the interaction between the eye, the canvas, the paint, and the attunement to the heart, to the present. So mindfulness and meditation is a lot to do with developing that capacity to attune. With food, it's knowing the right amount is difficult. If you come and live in a monastery or you come on a meditation retreat where the meal is the only interesting thing happening in the day, don't think many people would disagree with me. Again, this is not psychic power, this is just the law of averages. So, Amaravati is a pretty colourful place, but even here, the meal can be the most interesting thing. So, the judgment can be blurred. But it's a kind of interesting thing that if you're eating, You don't have to eat in slow motion or just sort of eat so many mouthfuls. But what I discovered when I started putting my formulae down and just following Ajahn Sumedho's example is if you pay attention, and the most helpful support for food is once you put a mouthful of food in, you put the utensils down as you're chewing. Like you have a knife and fork, you put them down while you're chewing, then when you finish that mouthful, then you pick it up again. So you don't have to be too rigid about it, but sort of basically eat one mouthful at a time rather than be sizing up the next one, which is what we usually do. And if it's really delicious, you have one in your mouth, one in your spoon, and you're eyeing up the next one. You've got a kind of three-part desire system going. So you're actually not even with anywhere near what's in your mouth because you're so focused on what's coming next and what's coming after that. So put the utensil down, pay attention to what you're eating. So you don't have to eat in slow motion or you chew everything 35 times, but just pay attention. And then what happens is that there's this moment where you know, okay, that's enough. It's weird. It's the kind of, the body has its own intelligence. It's like, you don't have to think, oh, it's very cold today, I should take more carbohydrate or, you know. It's like your body is already part of the living system. You don't have to make it that way. Your senses are attuned. And it's challenging because we can easily get carried away with food. But if you do this, it's very discernible. There's this moment where it goes, okay, that's enough. Then, of course, the desire mind says, well, I don't want to waste that. I was saving that for the end. Ah! The person who cooked it will be so upset if I don't have that. Or the kind of the inner legal team starts making a case, or just another mouthful. But if you pay attention and you have that renunciation to say, okay, just put the spoon down or the knife and fork down, stop, then okay, that's enough. And then if you watch, then you realize through the rest of the day, okay, I was right. So that quality of attunement is part of the living system. And then when you lose it and you eat too much or you kind of you don't eat enough, then, no, I said I wouldn't. And then you come the evening like growling and weak and feeble, and you go, I didn't have enough to eat today. I got dizzy and exhausted. Okay, pay attention. And again, rather than, okay, tomorrow I must, just, okay, I'll be mindful now. I'll be mindful of this feeling now. Is there some way I can ameliorate this now? So matanyuta is that quality of knowing the right amount. So it's a derivative of mindfulness and full awareness, or what's called sati sampajanya. And there's another list, a list of seven qualities. When the Buddha's defining the attributes of a well-rounded person, what's called a sapurisa, then matanyuta is one of those qualities. So the first is reflecting on the causes of things, where things come from. Second one is dhammanyuta. Then the second one is looking at the results of things, atanyuta. Then the third one is atanyuta, knowing yourself, knowing your own character. The fourth one is matanyuta, knowing the right amount. The fifth one is kalanyuta, knowing the right time. The sixth one is pugalanyuta, knowing other people. Is that person, is she a very quiet person? Is she kind of an outspoken person? Is he a mathematical type? Is a person an artistic type? How are they? And then the last one is parisanyuta, knowing the group that you're with. So like if you were invited to give a talk at a kindergarten, you don't say the same things you would if you went to a Cambridge Buddhist group. It's a different group. So those seven are all aspects of a well-rounded person, a sapurisa. So it's all to do with attunement. Knowing yourself, knowing where things come from, knowing where they're going to, or attending to that, knowing the right, knowing your own character, time and place, people and so on. And that really can only come through meditation. It's like you can't learn how to ride a bike without getting on a bike. You can't learn how to swim without getting in the water. So you have to really watch your mind. Otherwise, it's not a theory. It's not a formula. It's watching what your mind does with those experiences. And then, as with learning a musical instrument or a language or a sport, you hit a lot of dud notes. You get the words wrong. You forget the word orders and such like. So developing that skill takes a lot of effort and a lot of failing. But you don't develop a skill without failing a lot. You need to fail to develop the skill. You have to get it wrong in order to learn how to get it right. So but it's also rather like riding a bicycle. It's not a theory that you understood conceptually. There's something that's a whole body learning. And exactly the same way, Matanyata, it's a whole body learning. It's a whole being learning. But also not just getting a sense for that, okay, that's the right amount, or this is the right time, or that's enough. But then the renunciation part of it is like, okay, follow that. Like, okay, spoon down, or okay, I've said enough. That's enough.
Thank you.
So any questions from this side? Any more? Yes, there's one down here, the front.
Bhante, it's about Nikkama Sankappa, the one of the paths of the second factor of the Noble Eightfold Path. It's a bit of a mystery to me. Like, I'm trying to understand what exactly Nikkama Sankappa means in that context. Like, say, for example, if a layperson wants to practice the Noble Eightfold Path, to my understanding, it's to do with renunciation. But what sort of, say, if you want to practice Nikkama Sankappa, what sort of thing do you have to do to sort of do it properly, you know?
Right, well, it's a good question. So for those of you who are not familiar, so the Eightfold Path, Samadhi, right view, is the first factor. And then Sankappa is the second factor. And when the Buddha, which means right resolution or right intention, right thought, or right attitude, in a way. So the Sankappa then is the broken up or sort of subdivided by the Buddha into three qualities. So the thought of harmlessness, the thought of a non-ill will, the thought of non-cruelty, and the thought of renunciation. Those are the three aspects of it. So nekama is the Pali word, usually translated into English as renunciation. To go back to what I was saying in the main talk, our English word renunciation carries within that sense of going without something that really is yours or that you really like. And so it carries with it a sense of lack or diminishment that you're tolerating, almost with a begrudging attitude. Nekama, in Pali, it comes from the two parts, meaning ne at the beginning means not or without. And see, Ajahn Benita's not here, but so ne is from not or without or relinquishing. And then the kama is from sense pleasure, so not following sense desire. So that it's rather like the dialogue that the Buddha had with Margandhya that I mentioned earlier on, because I only referred to part of it, and so this is a good lead into the rest of that dialogue, which is really important. So Margandhya, this sort of rich business person speaking to the Buddha, like, what's wrong with sense pleasure? What's wrong with comfort and happiness and beautiful things? And the Buddha said, well, Magandhir, what do you think? If you were a Deva Raja, you're like a kind of royal Deva in the heaven of the 33 deities, and you were living in this Nandana, like a celestial grove, kind of beautiful celestial park, and you had 500 beautiful celestial maidens as your own personal sort of angelic harem. If you lived that kind of a life up in the Tavatinsa heaven, would you be interested in your luxurious life here down in Savati? Well, no way. Yeah. I mean, it's like, how could you compare it? You know, I'm a rich businessman, all right, you know, I've got a comfortable life, but living up in the Nandana Grove in the Tavatinsa heaven, well, of course it would be incomparably better. I wouldn't be the slightest bit interested in this kind of worldly pleasure. And the Buddha said, exactly. I experience through my mind the kind of pleasure that is as far above the pleasure of a Devaraja in the Nandana grove of the heaven of the 33, as far above that as that is above your comfortable life here in Savati. So I can experience unremitting bliss for 7 days and 7 nights without a single finger snap of interruption. Do you think even King Bimbisara, king of Magadha, can do that? He said, oh, I don't think so. So I can experience 7 days and 7 nights of uninterrupted bliss through the nature of my mind. So it's not that I discourage sense pleasure because it's so intrinsically evil, but rather I'm just not interested in it because I know something that's far better, far more enjoyable, far more delightful. So it's kind of interesting to me that in that teaching, the Buddha is kind of saying he's a hedonist. The Buddha is into pleasure. Might sound like a bit of a heretical statement, but he's saying the pleasure I experience just through the nature of this mind in its purity is far more enjoyable, far more delightful, far more complete, far more abundant, totally satisfying than any kind of pleasure that you can possibly experience through sight, sound, smell, taste, or touch, through the ordinary sense world. So why would I bother? Why would I be interested? It's just nothing. It's nothing special to me. So you know, it's just like if you were a caterpillar, say. And you're a caterpillar that likes oak leaves, and you've landed through good fortune on a nice, fresh, young oak leaf in springtime. And you go, wow, kind of caterpillar, wow. So total happiness, because you can eat your oak leaf, and that's all you want is the happiness of eating your chomp, 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 chomp. Yeah, good, chomp, chomp, yeah, good, chomp, chomp. And I realize I'm anthropomorphizing a caterpillar at this point. But I've watched caterpillars eating oak leaves, and there's kind of that. You know, I'm not psychic, but you can pretty much feel that's what's going on. It's like chomp chomp yum, yeah, good. Chomp chomp chomp, yeah, good. And so, but do I feel envious of the caterpillar? Would I want to be eating an oak leaf? No. You know, it's just why would I be interested? It's just not something that's appealing in the slightest. Because you know, I have a whole human world that I'm a part of that's of an entirely different order, and there's other kinds of happiness that are available that are far, far kind of superior and more delightful, more encompassing than that. So to me, that's a very important teaching. So the Buddha is not against happiness, he's not against pleasure, but the pleasure that comes from the mind liberated from greed, hatred, and delusion, the pleasure of the mind. Say awake to the Dhamma is just that much greater. So he say. What he explains to Magandhir is this: because I know something higher, I'm just not interested. So just as if you have some kind of something that somebody's really interested in, so that a wealthy tycoon like have a huge yacht or a whole penthouse apartment in Monaco overlooking the Mediterranean and kind of palatial grounds with swimming pools and fountains and the whole lot, and you say, and that they think, wow, I'm so great, I'm so rich, look at my yacht, look at my look at my wonderful penthouse apartment, look at my beautiful gardens. He says, look at the my view over the Mediterranean. You know, look what I've got. And if you're, say, not someone who's interested in yacht owning or having a big fancy apartment, or you're living in an extravagant part of a rich city, then, well, why would you bother? What's interesting about that? What's appealing about that? The person who is, focused on that value system, to them, there is a thrill. There's a, yes, look what I've got. But also, for someone who's, say, seen all the kind of liabilities, all the bills you have to pay, and the jealousy you create in other people, and the having to protect everything, you think, just like Badia in the forest, oh, no thanks, yeah, I'm happy without that. It's just not interesting to me. It's no, has no value. That would just be a pain in the neck. That would just be a burden. So in terms of the question about the Nekamma Sankapa, then it's, I think, taking the Buddha's response to Magandhya. It's like you learn to recognize that in you which is not needy, which is not dependent. So that it doesn't mean to say you have to sell your lovely four-bedroom house with your nice garden and your whatever, you know, sort of comfortable dwelling you might have, but rather, okay, I'm happy to have a nice house and a garden so that the family can enjoy that. But if the bank collapses and I get kicked out of my work and then all the money's gone, then okay, I'll go live in a hostel for a few years and put my life back together again if I need to. That's okay. So it's that that readiness to adapt to circumstances. And also, when you're not, noticing it's like, oh, you know, there's this feeling, I can't stand that, or what about me? That's unfair, it's outrageous, I've got to have. So then there's the mindfulness that recognizes, oh, look, there's that, I've got to have, or I deserve, or that's not fair, or don't they know who I am? You know, oh, look at that. So you're noticing where those attachments are, and then there's the active working with the attitudes, that needs to be let go of. I need to be recognized as a professional, to be known as a doctor, or as an accountant, or as a professor, or company director. That people need to see me that way. Well, what's it that wants that or demands that? And so then you are ready to be recognized as praised as something or not. Like that, say, that fewness of wishes, that quality. I feel that the advice that the Buddha gave to the Venerable Gotami, to his foster mother, those are a great set of qualities. So that if you want to develop that within your household life, again, I'm not encouraging everyone just to sort of sell your houses and give away all your property and such. Your kids would probably have things to say about that. But to change the attitude where it's easy come, easy go. You know, that you do the best you can to look after the things you have. So like we have a roof over the head for one night is the way we regard our dwelling, just clothing to cover the body. We just have a few possessions, but the possessions we do have, we have to look after them. Our training with respect to our dwellings is if you're moving out, you should leave it in a better state than when you moved into it. If you are leaving your kuti, even just to come over, you shouldn't leave rubbish lying around. If you have used a cup, you should wash the cups up. If you have if you've been reading a book, you should close the book, put it back on the shelf, put it back on the pile, put things away, so that if you'd keeled over and died, when your friends come to your kuti, they don't find the place in a total mess. But they know, oh my goodness, yeah, this place is really tidy. This is well looked after. So the few things that you do have, you take care of. If we get a hole in our robe, you have to mend it before dawn of the next day. You know, this kind of, you keep patching them and patching them and patching them until they are not patchable, that my attendants, my monastic attendants, will know that I wear things until they're rags. And then when it's usually someone, one of the monks will say, Ajahn, I think this T-shirt is ready for the the rag bin with more holes than t-shirt and, you know, 15 men's on it and the men's on the men's on the men's. Okay. But you use the things that you have in a caring way. So the in terms of nekamma, then, again, it's not justifying living a luxurious existence, you know, sort of comfortable middle class life, but you can use that, but rather like the Buddha's advice to the monk's use of the seven-story building. Like, if you relate to it as a something that's offered and you're happy to use it, if it's not there, you're fine. If it's there, you're happy to use it. I feel that's the most skillful thing. And so where you see you're attached, look, acknowledge that and say, okay, well, I know that's a good thing to let go of, but next week, next year, you know, like St. Augustine was famous for saying, St. Augustine, the Christian saint, said, Oh Lord, grant me purity, but not yet. And it's kind of similar to one of Lumpur Cha's very, very helpful pieces of advice. I think it's coming from the same place of contemplative experience, where he said 50 to 70% of spiritual training is to know that you should let go and not being able to. So, you know, like if you're addicted to cigarettes or to caffeine, I know this is a bad habit, but I'm just not off it yet. There's still the hungering, or knowing that you'd like to have a particular kind of car to drive around in, or you like to have a house on a particular street, and you're kind of really pleased when people ask you for your address, or ask you, you know, where your children are studying. You go, oh, well, you know, two of them are at Oxford, and, you know, one's at UCL, but, you know, she did get a double first in her bachelor degree. And so, you know, there's a kind of, look at me, you know, look what I got. And that's kind of foolishness, you know, because there's you can't stop that flush of pride arising, but you can know exactly what it is. And no, that's really stupid. So that the more that you can see where those attachments are, then the act of seeing is what loosens the grip. It loosens the identification with that. So and if you look at the teachings, the suttas and the Vinaya, the arahants and the Buddha himself, they had personalities. They had likes and dislikes. They had particular things that they specialized in, and things that they were good at, things that they weren't good at, and things that were pleasing to them, things that they weren't interested in. So it's not a matter of switching off your personality or nullifying your own character, but rather learning to, like Atanyuta, you know your own nature, your own kind of character traits, and then you work with that. You know, like Ananda knew that he was very kind of fussy and caring and thoughtful, but he was good at that. You know, he was the Buddha's secretary, the Buddha's PA. You know, so it was good that he was attentive and caring and was looking out for everyone's welfare. Mahakasapa was not like that. You know, he's the kind of stern ascetic off in the wilderness. But they both had their place in the Sangha. Yeah. Sariputta was a brilliant expounder of the Dhamma and had great meditational abilities, no psychic powers at all, none. Mahamoggallana, there's almost no Dhamma talks by Mahamoggallana in the whole Tipitaka. He was not a Dhamma teacher. He had amazing psychic powers, but he doesn't seem to have been able to do much teaching. He couldn't really explain the Dhamma, but he was, you know, really incredibly accomplished with powers. And they were the best friends, you know, Sariputta and Moggallana. So it's nekamma is not trying to wipe out your personality, but more, in a sense, being comfortable in your own skin, but without being attached to that, and just being who you are and letting the world make of it whatever it wants to. And on that note, I think that's enough for today. The clock has gone round past 4, so thank you for your good attention. And I won't be here next weekend, but somebody else will be offering the next Sunday talk. So. But I have a few more on the schedule for the rest of the summer. So please go well.